Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley, and I'm with my co-hosts Tom Coffeen and Scott Hogue. And today, you're just getting the three of us, but we're going to be doing listener questions. We actually got a couple that came in due to the podcast, and so we thought it was a great opportunity to actually answer some questions from you folks. So with that, we're going to dive straight into it. We got one of the questions in from a listener, James, who actually said, hey, what's the best way to get my own little bit of IPv6 address space? He's apparently in the Asia Pacific region because he said going to APNIC is pretty costly, especially if you want some address space just to play with. I think he said it's about cost him about $1,200 per year minimum just to sort of get some address space to be able to utilize. And he wanted to know if there's other ways to go about it. If there was some way to get larger address space, you know, for him to be able to build something out and lab it up and be able to sort of get his playground up and running. So, gents, any ideas, recommendations for him?
Tunnelbroker.net, man.
Yeah, that's what I use too.
Yeah, we've all been using tunnelbroker.net since the way early days, since it was brought online.
Yeah, I applaud James for wanting to experiment because, I mean, it's one thing to read about IPv6 in, like, for example, one of our books, and it's another thing to actually deploy it in production. So you have this phase where you're testing and learning and experimenting and getting to know it and doing some protocol captures, as Jeff Carroll said in our previous podcast. So, yeah, having some address space gives you some playground.
So let's, if James is going to listen to this episode, and we can give him sort of a walkthrough of what to expect, because it's kind of unique, the service that Tunnel Broker offers, and that's through Hurricane Electric, of course, which is a very early adopter of IPv6 at the service provider level. But what are the steps? Like, if we started from the beginning, so the first thing you're going to do when you go to the Tunnel Broker site is just basically create an account. And then from there, what's next?
You need to know your V4 address. So you need to do a, what is my IP? Find out your V4 address, because you're going to need that. Because you're really going to a website that then is going to auto-configure a router on its end. You're going to configure your router to connect to that. You're going to be tunneling V6 packets inside of V4 to that Tunnel Broker. And so that Tunnel Broker needs to know your V4 address for your tunnel endpoint. That's one item.
Right. And so then once that's configured and you've got a tunnel up and running, so of course James is going to connect to the closest, if he's in the Asia Pacific region, he's going to be connecting to the closest 6-4 server, the one that's nearest him. And that's happening through, I'm assuming, Anycast on the Hurricane Electric side.
Yeah, they designate routers. So they have designated routers for picking and choosing to configure. And then, you know, they automatically obviously set up a /64 for the tunnel interface itself. And then you configure your side with the appropriate /64 that they give you in the script. And they actually have a script configurator too, which is pretty cool. So you can just designate, hey, I've got a Cisco device, and it'll generate the tunnel interface configuration for you.
Right. Or even a host OS. It doesn't necessarily need to be a router, right? So you can, yep, you can route the endpoint of the tunnel directly to, say, your laptop.
Yeah. If you feel so inclined. Yeah. And then they'll give you an additional 64 to run on your side, obviously, for anything you want to do there. And then they give you it's perusing through the options in the Tunnel Broker. They'll give you the option to actually click a button and get an entire 48. Actually delegated down to you. And that's probably more what James is probably interested in, is you get a full Insight node configuration of a 48 to be able to play around with different prefixes, configurations, maybe a little routing internally.
So I get to beat my V6 address planning drum here, because, and this, I've used this example on numerous occasions when I'm talking about what a site is, right? Because we always talk about a /48 being sort of the minimum prefix that we're going to route to a site. And then the question is, well, what's a site? And I get to say, well, hey, a site could be the endpoint of your tunnel, even if it's just a laptop on a tunnelbroker.net tunnel that you're routing a /48 to. A /48, huge amount of address space, plenty for James to play around with, to do some interesting prefixing and carving things up. But then I guess he'd probably want to actually, you know, have that tunnel being terminated to a routing device so he could do more stuff internally in his own lab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's actually using BGP, mm-hmm, as part of that advertisement of that 48. And they're probably advertising you a V6 default route.
Yes.
As well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't need a router large enough to take full routes, UDP default free zone routes.
The sound of your Cisco like being brought to its knees.
Yes.
Tiny little 800 series router choking to death on BGP.
Because what are we up to with the default free zone for V6?
Oh, for V6, I think it's maybe 60,000-70,000 routes. It's the V4 routing table that would crush the device.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I think with that being said, that will certainly give you enough address space. There is another option. Obviously, you can go to your RARs and be able to, you know, register, get your own address space, and do the whole dog and pony there. It'll cost you money, but I know we have a handful of colleagues who all do this. I think Owen DeLong, who used to be at Hurricane and Akamai, is sort of well known for running his own address space for quite a long time. All right, both V4 and V6. But I think realistically, certainly if you're working for a company and the company wants to play around with it, that's the direction I would actually recommend going. It doesn't hurt you to go ahead and get an allocation, even if it's a small one initially, just to be able to play with, with the understanding that you may go back and ask for more. Mm-hmm. But so that's not a bad way to go. And then I think the final option is if you have a service provider, a residential provider that's providing IPv6 address space to you, and they're doing it as provider assigned address space. I don't know what the policies are for most service providers, and I don't know what it's like in Asia Pacific region, but there's a chance that you could just shoot off a help desk message and say, hey, I'd like some more address space, as opposed to the, /64 or maybe the /56 that they give you by default. You can send them a note and say like, hey, is there any chance I can get a 48 to be able to test and play with and see what their answer is. Mm-hmm. You never know.
Yeah, it may be subject to the class of service you have. If it's a residential service, for example, you might be just limited to a /60. If you had a business class of service, you could absolutely get a 48, right?
I guess there's yet another option, which is that, and I think James is interested in being connected to the V6 internet here, but if all else failed and you just wanted to play with IPv6, right? And I'm sure James already thought of this, but ULAs, right? I mean, I could configure, or even for that matter, if it's not connected to the internet, I could use any globally scoped address block, and I could use that to play around with in the lab. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of a last act of desperation to get your hands dirty with V6. If you can avail yourself of that first, second, or third option, that would be the way to go.
Yeah, that comes with an interesting artifact, though. When you use, either the documentation prefix 2001:DB8 /32, or you use, FD00:8, the ULA space, those aren't connected to the internet. They're non-routable address space. So when your host tries to ascertain if it has V6 internet capability, like a Windows host, as Ed has described many times, goes out and uses the network connectivity status indicator to determine how it should behave on a network. Well, it can't reach the network connectivity status indicator that Microsoft maintains on the internet. Mm-hmm. So then your host on that network will be like, oh, okay, well, I'm just going to use IPv4 only. And you're not going to get the experience you would with true internet service.
Well, you'll get at least one experience, but
maybe not the experience you want, right?
Yes, it could be V4 only. Yeah.
So I mean, that's one way to learn. It's certainly the best way to start learning how to troubleshoot.
which is it? RFC 6724? I don't remember what the updated one is.
Yeah, the source address selection.
Yeah, you'll get your butt kicked by that RFC. So that'll be
yes.
Yeah, good learning opportunity.
Yeah, that's the not so pleasant reading. I mean, even someone who is familiar with it, like myself, that was not the fun portion to write in my book.
Ed's toil building a fantastic flowchart paves the way for the rest of us.
That was not a super fun process, but yes, it's definitely something you have to keep an eye out for. And what's interesting, I think, maybe just from a host operating system basis, just as a side note, is that if you are playing around with that stuff, your network gear is going to maybe potentially perform a little differently than your host operating system. So mm-hmm. Windows may behave one way. You're going to potentially get, if you got, Mac OS running around or a Linux host, you might see slightly different behavior even for if they're using ULA or using documentation prefix or if you're using global unicast addresses. Mm-hmm. And so that bit of inconsistency might be alarming, but it's relatively well documented And you just need to be aware of what those default behaviors are. And as Scott mentioned, in the Windows operating system, if NCSI doesn't think V6 is available, it pretty much just says forget V6 mm-hmm. and just go V4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. ULA, it's kind of like a ginger addressing, right? It's the redheaded stepchild. It's treated pretty poorly by the policies.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. It really got smacked down between RFC 3484 and 6724 when they did the uplift for that mm-hmm. and changed around things. It definitely got the short end of the stick.
Yeah, and so it really kind of depends on what James is trying to accomplish. Like if you're just trying to build sort of a lab to test routing protocols, for instance, it kind of doesn't really matter what block address space you use and which particular one you pick, because it's not really going to be routed any differently. It really only starts to matter when you get into host OSs and how they're going to behave.
Right.
So it sounds like there's a lot. James has, hopefully after listening to us, he's got quite a few more options to consider, and not having to shell out $1,200 to APNIC, which from an enterprise standpoint, hey, that's not a lot of money, folks. Remember, you're getting a huge address block for, essentially chump change. Considering that V4 is not really around to get allocations for anymore, it's even cheaper still. Hopefully we've beaten that question to death. What do you guys think?
I applaud James's interest in IPv6 and, you know, wish him good luck, and, you know, keep us posted and let us know if you run into any more questions we can answer for you.
Let's jump into the next one, because we got another question from Joseph, who's asking about DHCPv6. When the heck should I use DHCPv6 versus when should I use Slack? And I think this is a pretty common question that we hear from a lot of folks on the V6 side, simply because it's like, you know, Slack is sort of this new thing, versus if you're used to V4, you pretty much have basically two options: DHCP or statically assigning something to the host operating system is really the V4 way, right? So with V6, we have this whole other mystery thing with Slack.
We should probably start with just the basics around how DHCP V6 and Slack are expected to function, because that's like a huge difference. And I think we may have just brushed on this lightly in the Jeff Carroll podcast, but the idea that, we're so used to just DHCP V4 being something where you have a DHCP server and you turn it on and your host, receives the broadcasts and knows how to ask for an address. But we've got a little bit more work to do in the V6 world than what we're used to in V4. It's probably a good idea to cover that first.
Yeah, it's that the routing advertisement and how it's configured indicates to the host how it should behave and go about obtaining its address. Mm-hmm. And those bits said in the routing advertisement dictate that.
And that's true whether I'm using DHCP V6 or Slack. Mm-hmm. So I've got that additional configuration work that I have to do on the router to make sure that the router advertisement is sending the information to the right information to the host, depending on whether I want to use DHCP V6 or Slack, or of course, mm-hmm. both. I could potentially use both.
Yeah. I think I've heard Ed, and I think you've given this advice to enterprises. You know, they should follow the same operational model that they have for V4. They should use that same operational model for V6. If you use DHCP V4, then it's just natural fit to use DHCP V6. Mm-hmm. And you have one standard, method, and they're congruent. If you're maybe a defense corporation and you statically assign V4 addresses, you could do that same crazy procedure with IPv6. Mm-hmm. God bless you, God help you. But that's kind of the nice thing about IPv6, is you have a variety. So you could do Slack, and maybe you're starting a brand new network, an IoT network, and that's where maybe Slack makes sense, or there's certain advantages to doing Slack, and you have the choice.
Yeah, so what would be in an enterprise environment then? You just mentioned one use case, which would be an IoT deployment. And maybe because the individual IoT devices don't support DHCP V6, essentially because they've got, cheap little stacks that just aren't equipped to provide that support. So I'm kind of forced into using Slack in that instance, maybe.
Yeah, where there's devices that just kind of come and go and they're ephemeral and you really don't care to keep track of the state mm-hmm. of what who has what address or what device has addresses. They just kind of come and go like mushrooms, or, you know, grow and disappear. Or they're like cattle. You know, maybe you don't really care to keep track of it. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's an opportunity to use Slack.
I think it's an important point also to bring up that many of the small Linux embedded kernels actually don't have DHCP v6 built in and compiled into them, because that's something that most of the major distributions go ahead and put in the operating system, mm-hmm. on your behalf for both server and the client side. But the reality is that if you look at just a general kernel deployment at the lowest level, almost none of the stacks include a DHCP v6 capability within the actual kernel.
Right.
So it's something, it's one of those weird things that's just sort of left out. And if these IoT vendors are going in and picking a stack, and they may not realize that it doesn't have DHCP v6, it's just not capable of doing DHCP v6. Mm-hmm.
And this is the client. This isn't DHCP mm-hmm. v6 server. It's like literally having DHCP v6 client functionality. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the reason why that's the case in these IoT devices is maybe they're run on battery. And every little packet that goes to and from them mm-hmm. is going to consume some battery life to send and receive some stimulus response of a packet, and any kind of packet that it has to respond to, that'll consume its battery life over time. Mm-hmm. So even in IoT environments, there are options to really lengthen the duration between routing advertisements. Normally they come out every 200 seconds from a traditional router, but you can really lengthen them. And you can also make those routing advertisements use unicast instead of multicast to really conserve battery life. That may be a consideration in an IoT environment that doesn't apply to a corporate network with laptops and mobile devices.
Right.
So it can be charged.
Yeah, a standard wireless network where you just got laptops and tablets and people run around with their cell phones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it sounds like there are instances where I might end up using both depending on the environment. But I've got a couple of choices with DHCP v6, right? Because, and this may not be, folks that haven't deployed it may not be aware that there's two different varieties. We've got stateful DHCP v6 and stateless DHCP v6. So maybe we should spend just a minute to characterize the difference between those.
Yeah, the stateless version, it's a very complicated terminology. It's using the routing advertisement as advertising, is setting the A bit equal to 1, telling the host on the network to Slack, but then the router sends across some extra information with the DNS information, mm-hmm. the DNS server, and the DNS suffix search order list mm-hmm. to the host. But the host is doing Slack, even though it's called stateless DHCP v6.
That's the O bit, right? That we're talking mm-hmm. about. The other yes. stateful configuration flag. Mm-hmm. 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 Super long, but yeah. that's effectively what's going on. And what we're really saying is, it's like, hey, go ahead and self-configure your address, but the other information that you need to know about the network, regardless of what it is, you're going to go get it from the DHCP v6 server, because that's centrally where we keep this mm-hmm. sort of, you know, repository of truth of where you need to go find stuff, regardless of what that is. It could be DNS information, but it could take other optional components from DHCP v6 to be able to provide other information to that host operating system. Really depends on what you want to do. And mm-hmm. obviously there are standards that are built around that, but that's the method that happens there. It's a combination of set yourself up an address and then go ahead and grab this other information.
That's right. But there's one piece of information that we won't be getting from the DHCP v6 server. And a lot of folks that deploy it for the first time are not aware of this. And you guys probably know what I'm hinting at here.
Yeah. Yeah. This causes serious confusion for a lot of people, because this is where we are not congruent with, right? We're incongruent with V4, because in V4, we're used to programming into our DHCP configuration the default route, right?
That's
the default route is a common thing that everyone says. The first thing I get from my DHCP server, I get an address. And then the second thing I get is where is my default route? Where do I go to get off this network to get to other networks? That's that piece of information. But maybe, Tom, you can walk people through, why don't we need that piece of information?
Because we get it from that ever critical routing advertisement that we mentioned at the beginning. So, and this is really the technical reason why we're going to rely on the routing advertisement for whether we're doing DHCP v6 or whether we're doing Slack, because that critical bit of information as to the default gateway to get off of the network is provided in the routing advertisement. And at first, this causes a lot of confusion and consternation if you're used to running DHCP v4 in an enterprise environment, because as Ed suggested, you're used to getting that default gateway or default route from the DHCP server. But there's a lot of advantages to decoupling it from the DHCP server. And if you think about it for just a little bit, it becomes pretty obvious that by not having that default route coming from the DHCP server, you can do things with resiliency and redundancy around having that default route for V6 always be available through the routing advertisement that, you know, regardless of what happens to your DHCP server, there's still some ability to get the host that information of how to get off of the local segment and get out to the rest of the network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's pivot on that, because maybe this is something interesting. It freaked me out the first time I saw it. Besides the DHCP V6 related issue about not having a default gateway, is also the fact that the router advertisement that you see is using link local addresses, and what you see in your host routing table mm-hmm. for your next hop is a link local address. Mm-hmm. You're not seeing a global prefix or public IP or you know, even what we're used to in V4 on a 10 class network, for instance, an RFC 1918. You're used to seeing another 10 class address as your next hop that's in your same subnet, right?
Man, is there no bottom to this wormhole? We keep going down and down levels here. So now there's a link local address I have to deal with on top of everything. Yeah,
I don't think that's too bad. And luckily, you know, the router advertisements is the same regardless of whether it's DHCP V6 or Slack. But just be aware that your next hop is going to look, you know, you're going to look in your route table and it's going to have that link local address that's popped in there, and you might scratch your head the first time you see it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't change the question about whether you should use Slack or DHCP V6. Maybe we should bubble back up to that, which was really the original question.
That's right.
All along, it's why one versus the other. And there's some politics and history that go along with some of this. I agree with Scott, and I obviously recommend that the operational principles are use DHCP V6 when you're using DHCP V4. And try and keep it operationally consistent. Some of the reasons why is, you know, you're already used to running those platforms. But there are some use cases where it makes sense for Slack to step in.
It sounds like you're right on the frontier of that shift to the question of DHCP V6 support. So I don't know if we're going to talk about that or not. And now we have to, because we've mentioned it. It's like
too late. Cast out of the bag.
That's right.
Before we had Schrodinger's DHCP V6 client support, now we just know that it's going to be a dead DHCP V6 client support.
Well, we're being elliptical here, right? So yeah, we got to open the box to reveal what we're talking about, which is the we've mentioned it before, I think, in another podcast, but the fact that we don't have client support, we don't have DHCP V6 support in Android, and we're not likely to anytime soon.
Yeah, yeah. So for those situations, you simply just set up Slack as intended, and things have evolved. I would say early on, this was a big operational problem. It was hard for folks who were in the operator side to be like, oh my gosh, I don't get this option. But I think some of the community came and met folks sort of part way on the operator side. So Microsoft on the Windows side, they advocated internally, and they got a new set of support, RDNSS. Support built into Windows 10, which means that you can now get DNS information from the router advertisement. That's really what that provides. That's what was the original RFC for that one?
8106, I believe. 6106 was the original, and then
6106 is
8106.
8106.
Updated one.
Current. And that one actually gives you preferential order on the DNS servers, right, that you take in mm-hmm. versus just having a list and you just pick one. This is it'll actually do preferred order, right, based mm-hmm. off of what's provided from the router advertisement. And those are all pluses, and that means Windows can Slack itself an address and be able to look up mm-hmm. DNS information. And for V6 only environments, this is really important, actually, because you're not going to fall back to V4 and be able to do a DNS lookup, because you may not have V4 operating on the network. So mm-hmm. you need a way to be able to get DNS information, and specifically an IPv6 DNS resolver that you can go query against to be able to go look up all the domains of the common way that we actually look things up on the internet, which is not by number, but by namespace. So I think that's super important.
Yeah. When you're debugging that, or you're doing packet capture on that routing advertisement, when it's doing RDNSS, you'll see this extra option 25, and that's where you'll look for those settings to see how the client may react to that type of a routing advertisement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I don't know if that really answers the question of DHCP v6 versus Slack, because I think every use case, and certainly in the enterprise, every business use case is going to be different. You may decide that, you know, if you have super strict security requirements, DHCP, and you need each host operating system to be uniquely identifiable, you know, DHCP v6 makes a lot of sense. And maybe you have to make a compromise and realize that your Android handsets may not be getting any v6. They'll be v4 only resources in that particular environment in order to meet your security mandates. Or you can simply just, there are options to be able to load a DHCP v6 client on Android devices as a third party, as add-ins that will give it the capability to do that. So, you know, you have options.
Yeah, and the risk, obviously, the wrinkle there is that you've got, you may not have control over those Android devices that are being brought in.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's like the BYOD challenge, where you may be sort of forced into this requirement of supporting both DHCP v6 and Slack with RDNSS, depending on your operating environment. But as to the question of what, you know, which you should run, yeah, you know, I think hopefully within the context of everything that we've discussed, you have a sort of a clearer picture, you know, what the options are and sort of the different requirements depending on the environment.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think this is a great question by Joseph. I think it shows that he's, you know, moving inward into his enterprise with his IPv6 deployment. Yeah, you know, because if you look at RFC 7381, you know, you start at your perimeter and it's kind of a while as you plummet across your backbone network before you get to your access network. So it's great that he's thinking ahead mm-hmm. about what's ahead and planning for that IPv6 deployment internal mm-hmm. to his enterprise. So great question.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's jump into the next one because it actually sort of dovetails about what we just spoke about, which was, Scott, you had some folks, you've been doing some training classes recently.
Yeah, I was doing a training class recently and I was talking about, it's RFC 4074, Common Misbehavior Against DNS Queries for IPv6. Back in the old days, like maybe 2003, when a host would do a query for any or a query for all for a particular, you know, fully qualified domain name, if the DNS resolver it was asking was really old and only knew about IPv4A records and those resource records and didn't know what a quad A resource record was for v6, if it got back a quad A record response, it would choke and could hand back to the client either an NX domain or no answer, because the client, even though it was dual protocol, it was using a resolver that wasn't really v4 only. Mm-hmm. These were early days, and right. It would cause the client to not be able to go to that dual protocol site. And so what this RFC states, and has been implemented widely in all clients, is that it separates the query into two separate queries. The client will send, and whenever you're capturing DNS packets with Wireshark, as Jeff Carroll would tell us how to do, we would look at you'd see an A record query go out in one packet and a quad A record query go out in a separate packet immediately after each other, like right immediately the same amount of time, but two separate queries. So if the A record query completes, but the quad A record fails because your resolver maybe doesn't know what a quad A record is because it's that old, time to upgrade probably, but then at least your A record query would have been replied to and you could then reach that device over v4.
Right.
Now the world has changed. We have quite a bit of IPv6. So the question is, why do we still do this? You know, does it make sense? Or could we go back to the old way of doing this? But the question I got from a student was, well, if I had a v6 only node, what's its behavior? Does it still do the separation of an A record query separate from a quad A record query? Because in a v6 only world, it's like, why do I need to do that when there's only one transport? It's a v6 only device, so it can only make a v6 query over, you know, TCP or UDP 53 to its resolver for an A record, and then sends a separate, it sends two separate packets. It sends a v6 transport DNS query to its resolver using an A record query, and then it sends a separate quad A record query. So it follows the same behavior, mm-hmm. but it was an interesting question about how things work in a V6 only world.
And you know this, Scott, because you labbed it up, right?
I wasn't sure and I absolutely wanted to answer authoritatively. So yeah, I labbed it up and opened up Wireshark and did some captures. Yeah, I have a portion of a test network that's V6 only mm-hmm. Because as you're testing, you know, what life is going to be like in the dual stack state, you would want to also check what is the behavior and test in a V6 only world. Mm-hmm. If you're going to go through and test something, you should test it in all cases, V4 only, dual, and V6 only, to vet everything out. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I checked it, and that's what I saw.
I suppose the next question is, in a dual stack configuration, do you actually get four queries that go out, one on two, an A and a quad A on V4, and then an A and a quad A on V6?
No, I haven't seen that. What I see is, because the client will choose the first name server in the list and query that one first. So whatever is the first one in its list, and your etsyresolve.com, for example, could have V4 or V6 name servers in it, it picks the first one off the list, whatever protocol that is, and that's, and it asks the A record and the quad A record query to it. If that one doesn't answer or fails for whatever reason, then it goes to the next one. It'll ask two questions again.
Because all the public root zone DNS name servers now have both V4 and V6 mm-hmm. addresses yep. available. I don't think there's anything, you know.
Nope, they all have both.
They all have them. Mm-hmm. But those are the sorts of things that are good to know. I mean, it's great that your students are sort of challenging, you know, mm-hmm. hey, what goes on when this sort of stuff happens? And really, you know, you need to understand, am I getting this information over V4 or over V6? And what's, you know, it's, mm-hmm. is that impacting me in any sort of way? Mm-hmm. Anyway, how are we doing, you guys? I think we answered three questions from listeners, and we really appreciate everyone sort of piping up. If you have questions that you want to shoot over to us, you can certainly hit us on Twitter. We have the IPv6 Buzz Twitter handle, and feel free to shoot us questions through that.
Yeah.
The Packet Pushers, obviously, or channel mm-hmm. that you can hit up directly to.
Yeah, there's a variety of ways they can contact us. But if we've ever said something in an article, a blog, one of these, you know, Packet Pushers podcasts, definitely call us out on it. If it didn't make sense to you, maybe we misspoke. So we love the very attentive listeners. We'd love to clarify if we've made a mistake.
And we make mistakes all the time. Far from perfect. We, like I said, we have to look stuff up in our, I have to look stuff up in my own book just to make sure I get stuff right. Well, hey, is that a wrap for us, you guys?
I think so.
Yeah. Those are three great questions.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, send us more. We would love to be able to get more if you have questions, enterprise, home, IoT, security, cloud, whatever the heck it is around IPv6, you know, shoot us a note. We'd love to be able to hear from you. And with that, hey, unlike V6, we've run out of space for the podcast, but you can grab all the hosts. Let's see, Tom, he's IPv6 Tom on Twitter. Scott's Scott Hogue, Scott Hogg is his Twitter handle. And then I'm E. Horley, so it's Ehorley. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or on iTunes, any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for the IPv6 Buzz. You can check out all the other content over at Packet Pushers at packetpushers.net. We love that you're listening. Thank you so much. It's been a fantastic year for us. And so long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.